This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey will return next week. Coming up, the planet Earth can feed all of its people, but only under a socialist system. New Yorkers may well like their mayor, Bill de Blasio, but the police commissioner is a very different story. And another Black person gets a show on MSNBC. So what? But first, there are reports of armed resistance to the U.S.-backed regime in Libya, with fighting in the southern part of the country, a heavily Black region. Dark-skinned Libyans have been the targets of ethnic cleansing by militias supported by the United States. Former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney visited Libya many times before the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi's government. She maintains contacts with the resistance.
It's my understanding that the resistance is alive and well, controls approximately 80 to 85% of the southern part of the country. Sabha, which was recently bombed by the, if you call it a government, the U.S. mercenaries that are nominally in charge. And the resistance, is my understanding from the reports that are on the internet, has taken over the largest military base in that area. And, of course, I have to say that these are people who look like me, and they have taken up arms, and they are fighting for their country. In fact, I had one person that I got to know when I was doing my 29-city tour around the United States after I returned from Libya, and he participated in one or two of those, went back to Libya and participated and is now participating in resistance acts. And so I can tell you from what I have been told that the resistance is flush with money. Money is not their issue. And now, because they took over the military base, they've got even more weapons, and they have learned, they know their country better than any mercenary. But, Glenn, here's something that I have to report to you that makes me extremely sad. I have been told by Libyans that among the mercenaries that are going in, being paid by the United States to fight against the Africans, are U.S. blacks. Now, that pains me greatly that you would see black people from the United States fighting for imperialism against their brothers and sisters on the continent. This is a complete reversal of what the black liberation struggle was supposed to be all about. This is certainly not what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. struggled to create in us. This is certainly not what Malcolm X and the Black Panthers, and we can go on with and on with the freedom fighters who continue to pay a price to this day inside the United States to see their brothers and sisters going off to fight for imperialism against African independence and African liberation. This is an aberration, and something has gone terribly wrong with black people in the United States underneath the policies of President Barack Obama.
Are these black American mercenaries and soldiers of fortune?
Well, they are mercenaries, and from what I've been told, on one single day, 16 of them were killed. And anything that is U.S. now is a target. And that's because who can be trusted? This is a terrible state of affairs. I was recently called to Switzerland by diaspora Congolese. The diaspora Congolese asked me point blank, what's wrong with black people in the United States that they are allowing this genocide in Congo to take place without saying a word? Where is the Congressional Black Caucus?
The Congressional Black Caucus, certainly when the late Congressman Donald Payne was alive and he was head of a subcommittee on Africa, seemed to be totally in favor of President Obama and AFRICOM's policies in Africa and in Congo.
Well, you're correct to point out that the Congressional Black Caucus under the leadership of Donald Payne had a backwards Africa policy. And when I challenged it, which I did, I was told that seniority rules, and of course in the U.S. Congress, period, it is seniority that rules. But that did not stop us from doing what we needed to do. And so there were some members of Congress who broke from that tradition, and we formed our own group. And then when we had a better leader of the caucus in Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson from Dallas, Texas, then she put me in charge of the caucus's Africa position. And so that's how we got around that. Congressman Earl Hilliard, who was taken out by the pro-Israel lobby, the first African-American congressman from Alabama, also was one who stood for Africa against the members inside the Congressional Black Caucus. So there was this struggle inside the caucus for relevancy and for meaning and for strengthening our responsibility to not only people inside the United States, but because all roads do lead to Washington, D.C., in our relations with continental Africans and Africans in the diaspora. Now all of that has been turned on its head so that you could see a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, for example, Gregory Meeks, fly to Colombia, whereas I was in Colombia with the Afro-Colombians. He flew to Colombia and was with Uribe, who is the president of Colombia, whose henchmen had kidnapped and exiled Piedad Cordoba, a black woman. And so the Afro-Colombians were extremely upset with this move because it bolstered Uribe in a way that tended to dilute the efforts that they were putting forward in solidarity for an elimination of Plan Colombia, to stop the dropping of pesticides and all that, the contamination of their land, the expropriation of their land, and the things that were happening to the Afro-Colombians. So the problem that we see now is as I asked with respect to the surveillance society, where is the Senator Frank Church of today in the Congress? But we could ask, where is the Earl Hilliard or the Cynthia McKinney in the Congressional Black Caucus? We know we've got a few of them, like Eddie Bernice Johnson is still there, but now we have a situation where Congressional Black Caucus leadership is telling caucus members to be quiet. Don't disagree with the president. That's what we've got now. And so it is incumbent upon us, those of us who talk, really need to run. That's what I think, is that we need to run. We need to figure out a way to have a slate of candidates for the Congress who come from among us and who have been proven. There was a time when those who talked very well were the ones that we looked to for leadership and representation. But we can't even trust that any longer, because I can think back in 2008 when I ran for president under the Green Party, and there were members of the black left and progressive leftists who basically opted to support the Democratic Party nominee, who was President Obama. And so we even have to be careful of those who stand beside us and walk among us, because really they might not be of the same value structure as us.
Which brings us to the question, how did you respond to the Congolese in Switzerland who asked you, what's wrong with black Americans?
I told them that black people in the United States had lost their minds. It's the only logical explanation when you have black people who are noted for their anti-war positions to be pro-war, for their anti-surveillance positions or police state positions, because, of course, we bear the brunt of the police state, to be silent in the face of this erosion of the Bill of Rights, the only logical explanation is that we've lost our minds.
Is this a passing mental illness, or do you fear something more permanent?
I hope it's passing.
All of this, of course, begs the question, is Cynthia McKinney going to re-enter electoral politics?
Well, I certainly wouldn't mind doing so, but the support has to be there. And when I say support, I mean it is not a thing just to put your name on the ballot and then, you know, hope that things work out. You really have to lay the groundwork, and there has to be financial support. And if the financial support is there, then I would have no problem putting my name on the ballot.
And lots of folks who listen to this program are wondering, what's Cynthia McKinney up to now? What's consuming your time?
Well, right now I am in a PhD program that I absolutely love, and I expect to graduate in August of 2014. And I hope that we will speak before that, so I'll have the opportunity to invite folks to come to my graduation and cheer very loudly. And my dissertation is on Hugo Chavez, and I'm just having the time of my life doing what I enjoy doing, reading and researching. That's what got me into trouble when I was in the Congress, because that's not a place where members are supposed to read and research and pose questions and get the answers to them. But I'm able to do that now. I'm at an institution that allows me the freedom to think and explore. That's the Antioch University PhD program in Leadership and Change. So I'm studying leadership, I'm studying change, and I'm hopeful that I'll be a better, even a better leader and a better change maker at the end of my experience there.
Cynthia McKinney speaking from Atlanta. Dr. Francis Boyle, one of the world's preeminent experts on international law, has attempted to rein in U.S. military aggressions over his long career. Dr. Boyle is a professor of international law at the University of Illinois at Champaign. He says the United States has reached new levels of lawlessness, constantly waging war against multiple nations across the planet.
I think after September 11th, 2001, the United States government is going for broke around the world. That is unprecedented levels. They've attacked and destroyed Afghanistan as a state. They've attacked and destroyed Iraq as a state. They've attacked and destroyed Libya as a state. They've attacked and destroyed Somalia as a state. Right now, they are attacking Yemen. They are attacking and destabilizing Pakistan deliberately and on purpose. They are threatening to attack Iran, and they are currently attacking and destabilizing Syria. They are also threatening China and North Korea. So I would say this is a new era. Yes.
The rationale is that people all over the world are trying to hurt the United States. But what country has committed an aggression against the United States in the last several decades?
None. I mean, even the terrorist attack of 9/11/2001 had nothing to do with Afghanistan. Even if you believe the fairy tale there, the 9/11 Commission report, it was done by 19 individuals, 14 of whom were from Saudi Arabia and organized in Germany. So this is simply scaremongering the American people to get them to support these belligerent and aggressive policies across the world. After 9/11/2001, as I point out in my new book, Destroying Libya and World Order, that in addition, near the end, also comments on Syria, you had Deputy Defense Director Paul Wolfowitz saying that the United States government was going to get into the business of destroying states. And then you had General Wesley Clark, who says in his memoirs that immediately after 9/11, he was in the Pentagon, and the plan was to start to destroy, I guess it was seven Muslim states. And they've already, by the way, Lebanon is being destabilized, and they've already amputated Sudan. So if you run down the list of states identified by General Clark that I quote in my book, it's clear they're going exactly according to plan. And now they are pivoting to take on China. Right now, there are war games going on against North Korea that are extremely dangerous. And they are currently engaging in the destabilization of Ukraine. The United States has always wanted Ukraine as part of NATO, so I guess they figure they're going to get it one way or the other. And as of yesterday, a Russian government advisor said that if this goes on, Russia might intervene militarily in Ukraine to stop it. They really can't afford to have a fascist neo-Nazi government there in power right next to them under the behest and the control of the United States. And you had the recent expose in today's New York Times by the Assistant Secretary of State Nuland with a U.S. ambassador there, proving that they're conspiring behind the scenes to overthrow the democratically elected government in Ukraine today. So I think that makes it pretty clear what's going on in Ukraine. So it's an extremely dangerous situation, Glenn. This year we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War. Any one of these flashpoints could lead to such a cataclysm. As a matter of fact, last fall, when Obama was threatening to attack Syria, President Putin put a picket line of Russian ships right there off the coast of Syria to make it clear that if he did, he was going to involve Russian ships. So we came very close to war at that time between Russia and the United States. We're encouraging Japanese militarists in the Pacific to challenge China. Anything could go wrong over these islands that Japan originally stole from China in their 1895 war of aggression against China. And yet we have said we are prepared to defend these purloined islands. So again, extremely dangerous situation. And any spark could set off a major conflagration, just what happened in 1914 with the assassination at Sarajevo.
At the Geneva talks on Syria, the United States insists that President Assad must go. What right does the United States have to dictate who's going to be president of Syria?
Absolutely none. Indeed, it's clearly an illegal intervention into the domestic affairs of Syria. And as I point out in my book, Destroying Libya and World Order, to deal with this threat by Kerry, this was condemned by the International Court of Justice in the Nicaragua case when Reagan was ordering the Nicaraguans to leave. And the World Court said it was not for the United States government to be determining the government of Nicaragua. So Kerry has no right to decide what is the government of Syria. This is not to deny that you have a pretty authoritarian government there, and there have been human rights atrocities. But we, the United States, have been the one arming, equipping, supplying, and training these numerous terrorist organizations that are now attacking the government of Syria. In addition, when peace negotiations were supposed to be going on last week in Syria, Congress voted to send weapons to the terrorist organizations opposing the Syrian government, and weapons were shipped to Jordan as if we were there to deliberately sabotage the peace talks? How can Syria negotiate in good faith when right when they're sitting there negotiating, we proceed to send weapons to terrorists that are opposing them? So we're not seeing any good faith here on the part of the United States government. The agenda here is still regime change. Indeed, I would submit the agenda is more than regime change. Again, it's basically to destroy Syria as a state along the lines of what we've already done to Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Sudan, Somalia, and are threatening to, trying to do to Pakistan, going back to what Wolfowitz said, the neocon Wolfowitz, and as confirmed by General Wesley Clark, Syria is on that list. Iran is on that list. Libya was on that list. Syria is pretty much destroyed now as a state. There's not much left that really can be rehabilitated at this point.
Dr. Francis Boyle at the University of Illinois in Champaign. Billions of the world's people live at the bare edge of survival, despite the fact that the planet produces more than enough food to feed them. Arun Gupta is a prolific writer, a co-founder of The Independent and The Occupied Wall Street Journal. He's author of a chapter in the new book called Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA. Gupta's contribution to the volume is titled Food for All, Creating a Socially Sustainable Food System. In the U.S. and increasingly around the world, huge corporations dominate food production, destroying small farmers and flooding societies with bad food.
The processed food industry in the United States is about $1 trillion. And there's about 315 million people in this nation. The processed food industry is about 300 or so companies. So in other words, each one of these companies has more power than a million people in the United States. Now, Europe often does it a little different. Like in France, they will support the small farmers a lot more, even though there has been a lot of consolidation in the various industries there. But what we find in the United States is basically the bigger the farm, the more head of cattle you have, the more revenue you have, the more acres of corn you have, the more subsidies you get, right? The people who least need it are getting, and it's not people, these are massive corporations, you know, corporate farms that may have 20, 50,000 acres of corn and soy in the field. And they're the ones who are getting the lion's shares of the subsidy. So it then becomes a socialism for the wealthy, and then these products are dumped on the market and into our foods. For corn, there's literally, it's in thousands of items. And I think a good way to think of how broken our food system is according to Vandana Shiva, humans have eaten over 80,000 types of plants throughout human history. Today, something like 75% of our food intake is dominated by just 8 plants. So that's things like corn, soy, wheat, rice, canola, rapeseed, which is canola oil, and a few other plants. So what we have is the illusion of choice. You can go into a supermarket and you can see this vast array of goods, but how is it really a choice when there's like 300 types of chips, 100 types of ice cream, 200 types of soda, often with the same base ingredients with them, just in different combinations with some different artificial additives and flavoring. And that's what we don't realize, that we've really lost a lot in our food system. And part of my argument is that under a socialist food system, we potentially would eat much better, not just healthier. We would have much more pleasure, much more tastier food, much more of a social type of food culture. You know, food is really a social artifact. We get our greatest pleasure not from eating alone, but from socializing. You know, why is it that food is so central to holidays and family gatherings and when we have parties? And I think a socialist food system essentially tastes better.
There are places in the world that are called breadbaskets because they're responsible for a great deal of food production, the Great Plains of the United States, places in China and India and elsewhere. But you argue that food production shouldn't be concentrated in these breadbasket regions.
It's a little complicated because I think it can be dispersed much more than it is, that, you know, we should be looking at having much more urban agriculture. And people who poo-poo that, they don't know the history. Essentially, during World War II, both Britain and the United States produced a huge amount of its produce, essentially through vacant lots, through garden plots, by people's homes. In England, I believe it was the majority of their produce was produced in these plots. In the U.S., it was something like 40% came from victory gardens. So there's potential for a huge amount. Now, when you look at different types of foods, you can also do like poultry, you could do chickens, ducks, you can even do small-scale aquaculture. But if you want things like pigs or cows, you know, that would be much more difficult. You do need more of a rural setting. Grains also and oils do require some degree of centralization, but not to the degree we have now. And certainly we also don't need to be feeding cattle the millions of tons of grain that we have, all this farmland that is then being used to feed cattle. They should be pasture-fed instead.
Let's address a fundamental question. Can the world feed 9 billion people, for example? Does the Earth have the capacity to feed a lot more people, or is the system holding back the ability of the Earth to make sure that all of its people are fed?
That's a great question, because it gets at the whole, like, natural limits and malthus. And there is no, there is, of course, finite carrying capacity, but it is not something that's set in nature. It has to do with the relation and systems of production. So right now, I think it's actually 7 billion people. There's more than enough food in the world for those 7 billion people. And I think we could actually have a much more sustainable, healthier food system that could feed the 9 billion people that are projected to be there by 2050. And if you can't feed the 9 billion people, that makes things worse, because then you're going to create all sorts of wars, social conflict, and global unrest. People do not kindly take the starving to death. But I think we have to get back to making local food systems primary, and then you supplement it with a larger scale food production for things that are much harder to do on the local scale.
And, of course, the wild card here is global warming.
Yes, that is very true. In terms of, you know, we can just take the case of Africa, where we've had leaders and activists in Africa saying, you know, that this is going to be a genocide for Africa based on how hot it's projected to get there by the end of this century. So life, human life, may even be impossible in large swaths of Africa. You know, if the monsoons start to dry up, this could just wreak unimaginable havoc throughout Asia, in places like China, Thailand, Bangladesh, India, that depend on these monsoons. And in Latin America, you know, if the glaciers basically evaporate, then the food system, the agriculture there that is dependent upon the snowmelt to feed the rivers, it's going to cause just tremendous social devastation. So this is a really big issue. And then, of course, we have the whole problem with the collapse of the oceanic fisheries due to all sorts of assaults: overfishing, pollution, climate change, the introduction of GMO fish that are weakening species. So it is, I think, a frightening scenario, but that's why I think it creates a greater imperative for having a socialized food system at all levels, at the community level, at the local level, the regional, national, and global.
Yes, can humanity beat back the threat of global warming if there is not socialism and collaboration between socialist countries around the world?
Well, it goes back to that old question, socialism or barbarism. I would rather that we try for a socialist system than descend into greater depths of barbarism this century.
Arun Gupta, a contributor to the new book, Imagine: Living in a Socialist USA. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio won about 70% of the vote on a platform of fighting economic inequality and ending the worst abuses of stop and frisk. But he disappointed many progressives when he brought back William Bratton as his police commissioner. Bratton is known as one of the architects of stop and frisk. But Robert Ganji of the Police Reform Organizing Project says he's confident that meaningful changes will occur under the de Blasio regime, which has promised not to contest a federal court ruling against stop and frisk.
We feel that de Blasio and Bratton have been sending signals, making moves to indicate that they are initiating at least potentially significant changes in NYPD practices. So we are encouraged by these signs. It includes the announcement that they will withdraw the Bloomberg appeal in the stop and frisk case, and they will reach a settlement with the plaintiffs. The creation of a new position, Deputy Commissioner for Collaborative Policing, which Bratton established. The video that Commissioner Bratton made, and that was posted on the PBA's website, and the PBA is the Police Officers Union, where Bratton talked about changes in policing in the city, less numbers-driven policing, more emphasis on quality and effect of arrests rather than numbers, emphasized collaborative policing. If he said collaborative policing once, he said it 10 times. The department has made an announcement that they're evaluating Operation Impact, and it seems very likely that they're going to significantly modify that program, and they're going to scale back on the use of rookie cops being the main police force that is included in that program, and that gets sent into the parts of the city that are considered the hot spots where crime is most prevalent.
A deputy commissioner for collaborative policing. That sounds like a PR assignment, frankly.
With everything that I've mentioned, all these steps, all these signals, we don't know what they represent in terms of a drive to drill down really deep and create sweeping institutional change. The concern is reflected by the cynicism or the skepticism in your question. So as advocates, we need to be vigilant. We will take steps to keep the spotlight on these issues and on the problems and the pressure on the politicians to make sure that the announcements and the reforms that they're going public with are not cosmetic and not simply window dressing, that they translate into meaningful change on the ground, that the NYPD becomes a fair and respectful police force.
The problem with stop and frisk was not about having rookie cops who were unsupervised, but that cops in general were getting orders from on high to stop and frisk as many folks in various neighborhoods as they could.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that the pressure was on the police to make stops and frisks in neighborhoods where a lot of low-income black and brown men lived. Over 85% of the people stopped were people of color. And we know that the young black and brown men were targeted by stop and frisk. And it was clearly unconstitutional, in our judgment, clearly counterproductive. Rather than it represent a strategic and discriminating approach to law enforcement, it was discriminatory, and it was like where a single rifle might work, you were shooting a bazooka, and you wound up, in effect, criminalizing and sanctioning lots and lots of people, hundreds of thousands of people probably, who weren't guilty of anything. Stop and frisk, as it was practiced during the Kelly years, was a very abusive practice, and its purpose was not to focus on people engaged in suspicious behavior. Its purpose really was virtually the exact opposite, to target and to stop and sometimes arrest people who were engaged in suspicionless activity.
And so we're talking about two terms of Giuliani and more for Bloomberg, in which these policies have been in effect. So we have veterans of the police force, including lots of supervisory personnel, who have been steeped in this philosophy. So how are the rookies the problem?
Well, the rookies are the problem from a general standpoint that, and so I've done a lot of work in the area of prison reform, and the younger correctional officers, and it's true of police officers too, the younger police officers were most often the ones, not always, that approached the job with a might makes right point of view. They're the cowboys. You know, they're going to ride into town and clean things up and knock people's head together and take over the streets, take back the streets. And so that's just a part of the human condition where rookies, in terms of at least in jobs like policing jobs and corrections jobs, they're going to most likely to be the people who are volatile, who overreact, who engage in excessive use of force. And it's seasoned police officers who are most likely going to be calmer and have a much slower burn approach to possible dangerous incidents. But your question is well taken, that there is a, unfortunately, a deep-seated culture in the NYPD that is toxic, that has involved the kind of abusive and racially biased activities and strategies that were very much in play during the Kelly Bloomberg years and during the Giuliani years. So I think the kind of changes that Brandt and de Blasio seem determined to make will be, it's a daunting challenge. On the other hand, it's also clear that a lot of police officers who are currently on the payroll and retired police officers, we know are very, very unhappy with some of the tactics and practices that were promoted in the Kelly years, particularly the quota system. The Patrolman Benevolence Association, which represents police officers, was a very vocal critic of the quota system. And so if Bratton makes some moves, as he seems intent on doing, to modify or abolish the quota system, that step will be received very well by the officers currently on the force. It's clear that de Blasio and Bratton are engaged in taking steps to reform the police department, to create an NYPD that is more fair, more respectful, that will move away from an emphasis on punitive interactions with the community, arrests, stops, and summonses, toward more collaborative, cooperative arrangements where the department is working with leaders and members of the community to solve problems. It's clear that's the direction that the mayor and the commissioner want to go in, and we as advocates have to support those moves to the extent that the new leaders make those moves and to keep the pressure on the new leaders that they follow through on those steps.
That was Robert Ganji of the Police Reform Organizing Project. Many people are anything but confident that real reform is on the agenda. Josmar Trujillo is with New Yorkers Against Bratton. He says the police commissioner will get no honeymoon because the community remembers how he ran the department the last time around.
We don't see the return of Bratton as a honeymoon period because we've already dealt with this man before. Many of us are old enough to remember the 90s. This is his second go around. The old saying goes, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And we're not going to allow ourselves to be shamed, and we're going to oppose him from the very beginning until he leaves the office of the NYPD commissioner.
And your position is he already has blood on his hands.
Correct. He has blood on his hands. He is widely credited with being the architect or the godfather, if you will, of stop and frisk through his broken windows philosophy that he operationalized in the 90s. He's also had a lot of private business dealings with private consulting firms that affiliated with right-wing think tanks like the Manhattan Institute, and he's all for surveillance, and he ushered in the Comstat era of policing. Of course, it's the blood of over 60 victims during his first regime, including Nicholas Taylor Jr. and a host of other victims that people remember from the 90s. But it's also what he's meant for policing, not just in New York, but across the nation, and the philosophy that goes behind it, which is a very aggressive, proactive, kind of reminiscent of the movie Minority Report, where they're trying to squash crime before it starts, that many people recognize affects communities of color to a degree that people are starting to understand, but the damage that this man has done is immense. So it's blood, and it's a whole host of other issues that we have with Mr. Bratton.
Yes, many people consider the broken windows philosophy to be the precursor of stop and frisk. Explain what the rationale was for broken windows and what actually transpired.
In the 70s, there was an article written by two men for the Atlantic magazine where they thought of this kind of radical idea of stopping crime before it starts. And at the time, no one really took it seriously, and it took quite a while for it to really become something that was considered practical or even doable. But George Kelling was one of those authors, and his co-author was somebody who actually said it was more speculation at the time. People don't really understand. It's just kind of a radical experiment or an idea of policing. And in the 90s, when this idea started to garner some momentum with people in positions of power, it was also coinciding with a natural drop in crime that had to do with the end of the crack era. It had to do with economic factors. There's a whole host of things that are never talked about. But broken windows was given the credit for this reduction in crime. So now the narrative we get is that broken windows equals crime reduction, which is the kind of simplistic media narrative everybody holds. And so stop and frisk was an aggressive child of broken windows. So broken windows would be like you stop the small crimes in every street corner. It would be a broken window. You'd send a lot of police to those areas so that the small quality of life crimes didn't encourage or didn't give criminals the idea that they could continue to commit crimes in those areas. And what happened with the development of stop and frisk, which is not necessarily a new idea in our opinion. It's something that's been going on in communities of color for a long time if you've been around. The name has been talked about relatively recently, but stop and frisk was the actual policy that formed around the time the decision in the Supreme Court of Terry v. Ohio that made it actually legal for officers to stop, question, and frisk you. And none of it would have really taken hold without this kind of idea of broken windows that Kelling, his co-author, and Bratton kind of really brought to the forefront of policing in America.
Now, de Blasio, with a great deal of fanfare in Brownsville, Brooklyn, announced that the city was not going to appeal the federal court's stop and frisk ruling. Do you see that as an action of good faith?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about this, I think, amongst activists in New York, whether or not the Floyd ruling was going to be something that was really going to fundamentally change the NYPD. First of all, I mean, we point out that de Blasio is really not doing us any favors. The federal rule, there's a federal trial, and there was a ruling, and the ruling was quite clear. The fact that he's willing to get out of the way of the ruling and not be Michael Bloomberg is not something that we see as a huge plus or something that we have to thank the mayor for. Not being Michael Bloomberg is not enough. So the fact that he's made gestures, and again, we caution people because it's not completely done. There's an entire process that has to go through. There are police unions possibly trying to pick up the appeal. It's standing in court to continue it. It's not all said and done. And also the actual details of what those reforms are going to look like haven't been completely ironed out yet. There's still some negotiations that the city and the plaintiffs have to go through. So there's the issue of whether we should look at it as something positive. I mean, of course, the Floyd trial brought a lot of things to the public, and we definitely think that those kinds of things need to happen, but we don't credit the mayor for it. And we're also very cautious about waiting to see what kind of actual details come out of the ruling. Already, the fact that the federal monitor, which was one of the key part of the ruling, is only going to be a temporary position for 3 years, is not something that I think was originally talked about before. It was going to be a temporary position. And we can point to Bill Brand's experience on the West Coast as both the commissioner of LAPD and as a consultant with the Oakland PD, that he has a track record of being tasked with helping troubled police departments. By troubled, I mean ones that have been proven to be racist and engaging in illegal police misconduct. He's had a track record of helping them not necessarily change, but go through the reform process on the West Coast. In the LAPD, for example, one of the federal monitors that was making sure that LAPD went through with its reforms ended up being an employer and a friend of Bratton. And in Oakland, when he was a consultant, he was tasked with using his experience to kind of help them weather the reform storm, so to speak. We find it also kind of coincidental where Bratton is here now as well, now that the NYPD had all this pushback by the community, and that we've seen not only a federal trial, but we've also seen legislation at the city council level. So in the sense that Bratton is here to kind of change the NYPD or that the appeal process is going to be something that's going to fundamentally change the NYPD. Again, fool me once, you ain't going to fool me again.
Well, have you at New Yorkers Against Bratton and your affiliated organizations seen any change on the street in terms of the attitude and behavior of the cops?
Well, the only change that we've seen on the street has been one of more aggression. Recently, there was an initiative that was undertaken by Mayor de Blasio with the support of Commissioner Bratton that started a whole project of targeting jaywalkers in a quest to bring traffic-related deaths down to zero by, I think, the year 2020 or something like that, which is basically a form of broken windows where you're targeting small crimes that I think probably the majority of New Yorkers have done it at least once, if not daily, which was jaywalking, and started to target them. There was an Asian immigrant senior citizen who was actually roughed up by the cops, and it was all over the newspapers here just last month because the cops caught him jaywalking and he didn't understand, and they just roughed him up as they're known to do. So the changes we've seen is that there's been an actual expansion of broken windows. And this is consistent with what we've heard happen on the West Coast with Mr. Bratton. He came in and everybody, even some civil rights voices said, oh, you know, he's changed, he's different, he's such a conciliatory figure now, and he's great, we love him. But the actual figures that we saw not only stop and frisk, but quality of life, crime, policing go up, particularly in an area called Skid Row. And there's been a lot of research on it, but unfortunately, some of that data hasn't made it into media. So all you hear is that Bratton's different. But for a New Yorker who's now has to watch, you know, for jaywalking tickets, or that has to deal with stop and frisk, which I've seen on a daily level. Just last night, I saw one outside as I was leaving an after-school program with my kids. Nothing has changed. The police may be a little bit more courteous. I mean, that may be what some people are expecting, maybe stop and frisk with a smile. But nothing will change.
Is it the case that people, especially on the left, are inventing a de Blasio that never existed, as was the case when Barack Obama came on the scene?
Yeah, I think for activists all across the country, but especially in New York, when you're dealing with this progressive savior story that the media and that politicians kind of thump their chest about, you have to be very careful. And you probably want to look at the examples of, most recently, President Obama. President Obama's kind of story is one where people kind of heard what they wanted to hear. I think it's been noted by Black Agenda Report and other alternative media that some of his supporters on the left, these are, you know, quote-unquote progressive forces, have been supporting things that they didn't support during Bush and during other conservative administrations. So there's this kind of feeling that they want to hear what they want to hear, and I think it's notable to point to maybe the anti-war movement, how it changed and maybe divided some people who consider themselves progressive when Obama was in office. De Blasio's administration here, similar in that he is coming in on this progressive wave, and he has a black wife, he has biracial children. He's seen as something different. He's seen as something that's coming up from the grassroots. He was fourth in the polls during the Democratic primary, much like Obama wasn't necessarily the front runner all along. There was this idea that this guy is really for the people and he's really getting a chance to change things and become a little bit of a savior for a lot of the politics, the activists, and the politics that people on the left have been trying to see come to fruition. So with de Blasio, we see the same things kind of manifesting themselves, because he came in never really saying that he was going to change or end stop and frisk, but he had a very, very nuanced approach to it. And he was somewhat, sometimes vague, but I think people also heard what they wanted to hear. And, you know, the example of Obama, who has had wars of aggression, he's authorized military action in Libya, and he's done things that normally that people on the left would have protested during a Republican administration. We felt that if Joe Loda was a Republican candidate had been the one to appoint Bill Bratton, that more people on the left would have come out and really opposed the Bratton appointment from day one. Not even from day one, even from when it was even hinted that he was going to come back. So there's definitely a lot of parallels. And if people take a look at the example of Obama, whether it's, you know, he defending NSA surveillance, not closing Guantanamo, military aggression, people have to look and say, what does that mean for the stop and frisk movement? does it mean that we will sit back and kind of get into this hope, guarded optimism mentality, like let's hope and see things are going to be different in de Blasio. Plus, there's all these reforms kind of on the horizon. Maybe they can come in and change some of the dynamics. So, you know, there's kind of like a guarded optimism that people have. And New Yorkers Against Brat and our group really kind of wants to make sure that we take all types of tactics to oppose not only stop and frisk, but police brutality, Muslim surveillance, all the things that we've seen from the NYPD. Our group is dedicating themselves to opposing Bratton, and whether it takes a few months or whether it takes years, we're going to get him out one way or another. It's kind of similar to what some people remember with the Kathy Black appointment during the Bloomberg administration, that elements in the education activist world kind of got together and said this was unacceptable. And that's what we wanted to see with Bill Bratton, because what he represents for people of color, I think you can clearly see that there is not only a policing agenda, which is broken windows based, but there's also a corporate agenda, which is that he comes in hobnobbing, rubbing elbows with corporate America. He's very much on the right wing kind of neoliberal area where there's an attempt to kind of paint a progressive sheen onto what's essentially a very radical right-wing vision, which is policing of communities, and we feel that these are communities that are also facing gentrification, which there's no coincidence, and very public relations-heavy campaign to kind of discredit the opposition to him and kind of make everyone feel like everything's okay. If people remember, Giuliani, when he fired Bratton, he didn't fire Bratton for any differences in policy, per se. He fired him because Bill Bratton was getting a little bit too much coverage in the media. He was a little bit too good at it. I mean, he is a media-savvy commissioner, perhaps the most media-savvy commissioner that we've ever had it in New York and maybe in the entire nation. He's considered America's super cop. So with that comes another side of a challenge for the activist world. It's not just the policies will not change, but it's also he's changing the conversation on us. We managed to get the conversation onto one of racial profiling and discrimination, and he's essentially going to take that and undermine it by being with de Blasio, this progressive police commissioner, which he is the farthest thing away from.
Josmar Trujillo of New Yorkers Against Bratton. It used to be that the appearance of a black person in a high-profile position on television was cause for celebration. But nowadays, black journalists seem politically indistinguishable from the rest of the corporate crowd. Joy Ann Reed, for example. Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
Back in 1962, when I was 12 years old, growing up on the south side of Chicago, and a black face showed up on television, I remember my mother going to one of the windows of our apartment and shouting to the neighbors whose windows faced us less than 20 feet away, "Quick, quick, there's one of us on Channel 2. To be fair, she sometimes used the phone for this too, and I recall receiving these calls as well as seeing them made. That's really how it was back in the day, a half century ago. We knew we were black, we knew we were here, we knew we mattered somehow, but in the world of corporate-owned television, we had been rendered all but invisible, made pretty much to disappear. There really were not a lot of black faces on the tube at all, so seeing one was a kind of affirmation, a tangible proof in a strange way, almost as if the world brought to us by corporate-owned broadcasting was more real than our own lives, that we really did exist, that we really did matter somehow in the scheme of things. We were looking for our own faces, for our own stories, for our own voices in corporate media and in public life. And since we'd never even been able to pretend to have these things before, the quest for them assumed an enormous importance for us that is hard to understand in today's world. A lot has changed in 50 years, and a lot hasn't. A few things have gotten better, and many others have gotten worse. Black unemployment is still double white unemployment, and black wealth remains a tiny fraction of white wealth. Gentrification is still the only model of economic development urban areas have to offer, and the number of black faces in prisons and jails has grown enormously since 1963, the last year when whites were a majority in U.S. prisons and jails. But black voter registration has never been higher. There have never been more black elected and appointed officials on every level, from mayors to sheriffs to legislators and generals and even a president. So indeed, things are getting better, at least for some of us. Things are certainly looking up for the family and friends of Joy Ann Reed, who's now getting her own slot on the MSNBC TV daily lineup, alongside Al Sharpton, Rachel Maddow, Weekender Melissa Harris-Perry, and the rest of that crew. Just as Fox News is the propaganda arm of the Republican Party, the White House and corporate Democrats, as if any other kind really matter, have MSNBC on lockdown. You do not earn a daily slot on either side of corporate media if you're not a consistent and effective shill for corporate interests, for the privatization of public education, for U.S. imperial interventions in war crimes in Africa, South Asia, and the Americas, for fracking, for the unfettered police spying, and for only attacking the bad things that the other party does. That's Joy Ann Reed to a T, and that's how you earn those slots at Fox or MSNBC, and that's how you keep them. The last real journalist with a daily MSNBC spot was Phil Donahue, who was fired for giving airtime to lefty criticisms of the invasion of Iraq. The big boys at Comcast, which owns MSNBC, must have a lot of confidence in Joy Ann Reed to use her blackface to effectively represent their interests. A half century ago, we imagined that if there were more black faces in more high places, they would represent our interests. Silly us. We really didn't see this coming.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Melissa Gerson.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.